Well, thank you, everyone, for remaining attentive. And I know there's good reason, because we have a great speaker now to keynote our panel discussion, our forum today. It's a great honor and a great good fortune when the person whom everyone in our working group who was consulted agreed would be our single best choice to keynote this address or keynote this forum today agreed to do so. We're thrilled to have Congressman Mac Thornberry from Texas here today. As you know, the congressman has been one of the leading voices on national security policy for a long time, but also on the issue of defense innovation and transformation. He was very important in the revolution of military affairs debate of the late 1990s. He was quite prescient in thinking about homeland threats, calling for new measures to address them a decade or more ago. He's been involved more recently on a special task force in Congress on the cyber threat. He's a fifth-generation Texan. And not only does he think about ground operations as well as high technology here in Washington, he's a rancher back home, so he covers the full range from traditional missions to future tasks of the nation and of warfare, and we just could not be more thrilled to have him here today. As you know, the basic ground rules, the congressman will speak for whatever amount of time suits him, and probably 15 to 25 minutes, and then he'll have about a half hour for your questions. And so, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Congressman Mac Thornberry of Texas.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Dr. O'Hanlon. I appreciate the kind introduction, and I appreciate the work that the task force and Brookings has done our defense capabilities, and especially including the defense industrial base. I also appreciated the chance to read your new book. Lots of good and interesting ideas in there, a couple of very flawed judgments, but I'll try not to talk about that at the moment, but it's very helpful. But I think when you think about the defense industrial base, the kind of place to start is that if the United States cannot build something that is crucial for our national security here at home, if we can't build it here at home, then that ought to be a major concern for us all. And if we only have one supplier of something that is very important for our security, weapons, equipment, or whatever, then that ought to concern us too, if we believe at all in free markets and the benefits of competition and innovation. And yet, one of the challenges we face moving ahead with tighter and tighter budgets is we're shrinking the number of people who can build things. And to me, what we really need is that culture of innovation. And so I'm going to zoom out just a little bit from the defense industrial base. Actually, it's similar to a lot of the things that you just heard, I think, from the last panel. But I'll start with two propositions that are blatantly obvious to everybody here, but nonetheless, I think, shape the environment that we all operate in. One is that the world is changing fast and is very uncertain. And those changes are not making it simpler. They're not making it cheaper. They are just adding complexity to the national security challenges we face. One of the things I do is try to follow some of the business literature about how companies succeed and fail. And I think it's interesting that that there's been a fair amount of writing about how companies can survive in a rapidly changing, uncertain time. And Friedman wrote in The World is Flat that looking at those experiences should be a warning to all businesses, institutions, and nation states that are facing these challenges but lack the leadership, flexibility, and imagination to adapt. You think leadership, flexibility, and imagination, and you compare it to the Pentagon, leadership's probably there. Flexibility and imagination, maybe not so much. And then I'm also reminded from studies that show that the record of our ability to predict the nature of the next war, not to mention its causes, location, time, adversary, and allies, has been uniformly dismal. So we've got a lot of change going on, a bad record of predicting what's going to be ahead, And yet the change happens anyway. The second proposition that's blatantly obvious is that budgets are going to be tight regardless of who wins the next elections. There's not going to be a whole lot of money to spend at defense. We're not going to be able to throw money at the problem. Now, I do believe that Congress will find a way to turn off the sequestration that is scheduled to take effect in January 2013 and substitute other savings for that mindless across-the-board sort of cuts that would take place otherwise. I can't tell you exactly how it's going to happen. I can't tell you exactly when it's going to happen. But I do think there is agreement on both sides of the aisle, not only for defense but the domestic programs, that that's the dumbest way to make cuts. So finding other savings to substitute, turning off the sequestration, I think will happen. But still, in the bigger picture, we're going to have very tight budgets. So we've got rapid change, not a lot of money to spend. What's the answer to that? It can only be innovation and flexibility. Of course, Secretary Panetta is going to release some details of the defense budget today. I'd just like to make the point that leaner and smaller does not automatically equal more agile. And you see those phrases grouped together a lot, leaner and more agile. It's not the same thing. One does not automatically follow from the other, although certainly more agile, I would argue, is one of the key goals. But just because you shrink the defense budget does not adequately make the Department of Defense or the military more agile. What we really have to look at, and this is one of the reasons I don't think you can look at the stuff we buy, I think we have to look at everything from people, and that's everything from pay and benefits to training to who we promote and why we promote them, to organizations, to the technologies we pursue, to the ideas we pursue. Colonel John Boyd of OODA Loop fame says it's people, ideas, and hardware in that order. And I tend to agree with that. And at the same time, change is hard. Those who have studied it have found that when you major attempts to change within organizations fail about 70% of the time. So we shouldn't think that it's ever easier. One of my favorite quotes is from Dr. Edward Teller in his autobiography, where he said, "The substance with the greatest inertia known to man is the human brain. And the only substance more inert is the collection of human brains found in a large organization such as a military service or a faculty of a university," which you ought to know. But it strikes me as part of our challenge. A few years ago, I was on a commission called looking at smart power, which basically meant the combination of hard and soft power so that you have a full range of capabilities that can be employed in a way that is needed and will be most effective and most efficient at the time you need them. I mean, that was kind of the basic underlying, and that looked at how we could develop that full range of capabilities. I'm kind of thinking what we need in defense is something that one might call smart defense, a full range of capabilities that could be employed in the right combination, and you just heard some of that in the last panel, for the circumstances that we need. Now, I don't have all the answers. I'm not smart enough to write a book on what those answers should be. But let me just offer some at least elements that would be included in smart defense. Number one is I think it ought to be based on knowledge and understanding. Now, that's different from being based on information. We collect loads of information. But sifting through that information and making sense of it so that you really have knowledge or even better yet, understanding is another step. Some of that comes from the intelligence community through secret collection and through open source collection and an analysis of that information. But I'd suggest a lot of it comes from understanding the religion, the cultures, the history of places. And that gets to some of the criticisms, for example, that General Flynn made of our early years in Afghanistan, where we really didn't understand and spent money needlessly, probably spent lives that did not need to be spent because we did not have that deep understanding of where we were. If we're going to choose what sort of tool to use for a particular outcome, we have to have that sort of understanding. And that doesn't mean all the money we spend on intelligence is automatically sacrosanct. But I do think one of the dumber places to cut would be to cut intelligence capability, which would reduce our ability to develop the kind of understanding that we need from a strategic level down to the tactical level. You can't invent it when a crisis develops. It has to be embedded ahead of time so that you can draw on those resources and that expertise when you need it. And that presents all sorts of challenges. You know, for example, with our growing dependence on ISR, everybody wants it, everybody wants their own, and everybody wants a lot of it. Now, part of what I've tried to ask is who's looking at the bigger picture about how all of these platforms fit together? And maybe what we, with the need for and desire for persistent surveillance and full motion video and so forth, multiple roles on one platform, who manages those platforms with multiple roles and that could benefit other services? I think that's organizational, that's cultural, that gets into some of the personnel issues. Another example, a tempting place to cut in the defense budget is professional military education. Again, I don't think that that every dollar we spend there is sacrosanct, but I think one of the dumbest places you can cut is the educational system that helps prepare your military to deal with the challenges in the future. Ben-Gurion wrote that the most dangerous enemy to Israel's security was the intellectual inertia of those who are responsible for its security. Now, if that was true in Israel in its early dangerous days, I would suggest it's also true for us. Another pillar, I think, of smart defense would be to drawing upon that knowledge and understanding, mature our capability to work by, with, and through others. Now, that's kind of the traditional special forces mission. We all know some things only the United States can do. Most things probably the United States does better than anybody else. But we're going to have the ability to help others get some things done good enough and not necessarily do it all ourselves. Much of that will inevitably involve irregular warfare. I'm a little concerned that there is a temptation now that will accelerate to get, quote, back to normal. But we had a hearing in my subcommittee late last year where it turns out that normal, at least 83% of the time since 1815, has been irregular warfare. And their other research has shown that in the first two-thirds of the 20th century, there were 48 small wars which, taken together, involved as many people as the world wars and involved as many casualties as each of them. And just think about where we've been the last 20 years, you know, Bosnia, Somalia, all through the list. So I think we need to be alert to the danger of putting what we have learned at a very high price over the past decade back on the bookshelf. And so I will, in my subcommittee that oversees special operations, we're going to continue to have hearings looking at personnel, training, those things involved in irregular warfare to make sure that does not happen. But if you're working by, with, and through others, that involves other things. It involves greater interagency effectiveness, and we've been talking a lot about it. There have probably been some advances, at least since the early days of Iraq and Afghanistan, but clearly we're nowhere near where we ought to be. And the expeditionary nature of other government agencies. Let me just mention one example that maybe we ought to all watch for. The Coast Guard has, among its missions, maritime law enforcement, customs, border control, drug interdiction, and they do some international training, But it's not integrated into our national security planning. It's not prioritized as far as overall national security objectives go. A lot of folks think it's not sustainable. And yet what a lot of these countries need are the very things that the Coast Guard offers. We have to improve the ability to use the expertise in one part of the government for national security purposes. I have heard anecdotes of a complete mess at the Afghan-Pakistan border when the military was trying to control the border access, until they bring some Border Patrol agents who kind of say, you go here, and gets things kind of straightened out and smooths it along very nicely. Those are just kind of some simple examples of where we've got to make sure other government agents we can draw upon other government agencies to help in national security purposes as we work by, with, and through others, because we can't do everything, we can't be everywhere, and we don't have to have everything done perfectly. That gets messy. You're dealing with partnerships and coalitions and that sort of stuff. But yet, it seems to me it's an essential part of a smart defense. I think smart defense also has got to include some countercultural issues. Dr. O'Hanlon mentioned one, at least in his book, where he talks about changing the crew of a ship while it's out on its mission, not bringing it back and forth. I've often thought that longer terms of service in a lot of key positions makes a lot of sense, and I've just seen it in my own district. I have one Air Force base in my district that is a training base, and the one-star general who runs it wrote 2 years doesn't even get around before he's out the door and the next guy's coming in. There's been some very fine people who do that, but by the time they learn who's in the community and what training goes on there and what goes on, they're off to the next thing. That cannot make sense. And you take that into lots of other positions, I think we hurt ourselves. And also, if you look back historically, some of the great innovators have been in their jobs a long time. You know, they couldn't blast Rickover out. He was there 30 years, and yet tremendous capability came from his tenure there. I think there are other countercultural changes that we need to explore. In 2005, Tom Barnett wrote that the Iraq war will not make a lasting impact on the U.S. military, but the Iraqi peace will redefine it. The defense industrial complex will be focused into wrenching change from producing the few and the absurdly expensive to cranking out the many and the cheap. I kind of thought he was right when he wrote that, and yet it has not happened yet. And I guess the question for us to think about is, if that is desirable, to go from the few and the expensive to the be able to do the many and the cheap, are we even able to do that? Is the culture, the organization and structure able to carry that off? I also think more accountability and responsibility and accountability for decisions is essential. Partly that goes with longer tenure in certain positions. But it's hard to find sometimes, especially in these acquisition programs, who's responsible for decisions and for programs that don't perform as we want. Briefly, I'd just say I think a smart defense means that we have to be prepared for new domains of warfare. We've been talking about space for a while. I think one could even argue information may be a domain of warfare, not necessarily an enabler. But cyber is the one that just jumps out as challenging so many of our approaches and assumptions, from what constitutes a use of force to how do you have command and control or even oversight when something is happening at the speed of light, to personnel issues. How do you attract and keep the kind of people that are the most effective in the cyber world that may not meet the other criteria we often think of for military service, to just a host of issues? But I would say, with Moore's Law, I can't imagine a place where acquisition reform is more necessary than in the whole field of IT and cyber. And again, that requires the kind of cultural change. Let me just finish with turning the mirror back on Congress, because it shares some of the responsibility, not only for the problems we face, but also for the solutions. Again, this is not a comprehensive list, but some thoughts about what Congress needs to do to support a culture of innovation and a smart defense. Number one, to be blatantly obvious, you don't get a lot of innovation with continuing resolutions, particularly with those that go on for a couple months at a time. In a larger sense, in times of budgetary uncertainty, companies are rational and they become more cautious. Now, we may have some disagreements about where the overall economy is, but I have talked to hundreds of businesses in my district and around Texas, and I guarantee they are worried about what's going to happen with taxes. They're worried about the regulations that are coming. They're worried about the debt ceiling, you know, how that's going to, what that did or could have done to credit. Those who are government contractors are worried about whether they're going to get their money or not. And they are not going to take a risk. And they're certainly not going to stick their neck out to put R&D money into something that may or may not pay off. And I think that's what you're seeing across the economy, which is why the recovery has been so anemic. But the point is, Congress, working with the president, has got to put some greater certainty into these key issues of taxes, regulation, and appropriation. We're going to vote in the House. We're going to vote next week on the beginnings of some budget reforms. There are about 10 of them that the Budget Committee is looking at. One of them that we're not voting on next week, but they're considering, is a two-year budget cycle. I think that would be a good thing to provide some of that stability and predictability that managers need, whether you're in the military or whether you're a contractor. In the meantime, I think it's really important for the federal government to keep up its R&D, because as budgets shrink, companies are going to put less of their money, rationally, into R&D. We've still got to research and be prepared for the future. That means the government cannot slack in its R&D efforts for funding. We also, Congress cannot overreact when there's a problem. And I think a lot of the barnacles that have been added to our defense have come from Congress trying to be responsive but basically overreacting. You have a media report about a $600 toilet seat, and all of a sudden you've got three commissions and six toilet inspectors, you know, that have got to look at it all. I mean, that's the sort of phenomena, I think, that has just built up over time. And that gets back to the real need for accountability, for people, managers being able to make decisions and then being able to hold them accountable for those decisions without all the second guessing and without all the mother may I's that have developed in our system. I think it's also important for Congress to understand the consequences of various proposals. Apparently today the Secretary is going to recommend a reduction in the size of the Army. And they will make they will emphasize the fact that we're not only going to not shrink special operations, we're going to grow in the future. Well, the truth is, special operations depends on the conventional Army for much of what it does. So part of our job, I think, is to look at what the consequences of those conventional cuts could be on special operations and make sure that really we're not cutting off our nose to spite our face. Obviously, committee jurisdictions need to be sorted out. There's been a ream of studies since 9/11 that have made recommendations for Congress. A lot of them have been ignored. I worry a little bit that there is a, to borrow a phrase, soft bigotry of low expectations when it comes to Congress and its ability to get its act together on national security. But and don't be guilty of that. Please help us to lift up to a higher standard. So I think the summary is there is much ahead of us that is unknowable and beyond our control, But as in life in general, I may not be able to control what is coming at me. What I can control is how prepared I am for it and how I react to it. Our goal ought to be the kind of agility to react and the kind of preparation that means we are able to effectively react in a time of rapid change and uncertainty. Eliot Cohen wrote a great book about the war leadership at the Heights, where he looked at Churchill and Lincoln and a variety of folks. Bottom line was, it is in his ability to adapt and not in the capacity for a grand design that the war statesman finds his largest test. I think that's true with us, too. It's in our ability to adapt, not in our ability to sort it all out ahead of time, that we will find our greatest task. So, thanks for having me.
How long, folks, are you?
Feel free.
Please prepare your questions. I'm going to open up, if I could, Congressman, with just one of my own.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you're hopeful that Congress will find a way to soften sequestration or to replace it with something else. And I realize you were wary of predicting the character of that new bill. But can you at least sketch out for us the possibilities? Because to me it looks pretty hard in an election year where if you're looking to find $500 billion in 10-year savings somewhere else or increased revenue, well, the increased revenue seems like a non-starter, frankly, for both parties this year. Entitlement reform seems too hard to do quickly. And domestic discretionary accounts have already taken an equal brunt, as did defense, in the Budget Control Act's implications so far. So what are even the range of possibilities that you would foresee where this could be possible?
Two things. One is, I think the budget that will, at least the Republicans will vote on in the House, will substitute other savings. Now, the budget's not going to get enacted, but at least it will lay out the game plan to do that. But remember, you don't have to find $500 billion savings. What you have to find is about 40 or 50 for the first year. And so, you know, again, kind of shrink the expectations a little bit. If we need to find substitute savings for the first year, and if you look at the variety of things that the super committee looked at, there are some fairly easy, low-hanging fruit that could be used for that. Now, the harder question is, what's the legislative vehicle? And as you point out, what is the politics of the moment? What does it get attached to? And that's why I think it's really hard to predict. But to find the savings to turn off, and the 40 to 50 is, I think, for across the board, I think that's not that hard.
Great. Please, and Harlan, why don't you start? Please introduce yourself after waiting for a microphone.
Congressman, I'm Harlan Ullman. Good to see you again. Thank you for your comments. My broader question is, what is your biggest and boldest idea to get this fixed? But let me put it in the following context. It seems to me the title of this conference, The Future of National Security Industrial Base, smacks of the 19th century and the 20th century for a couple of reasons. National security is too often taken to mean defense when it has to be much broader. And as we've learned and you pointed out, military force may or may not be necessary, but it sure as hell wasn't sufficient in Afghanistan and Iraq. And you were talking about knowledge and understanding. We should be looking not so much at an industrial base, but an intellectual base that goes across all of government. So with that as context, what do you think would be a bold, big idea that may be able to move us fully into the 21st century, when your notion of knowledge and understanding, it seems to me, has got to be the centerpiece of our future national security?
I don't think there's a magic answer or silver bullet that accomplishes what I would like to accomplish. I do think, and forgive me, I may be somewhat parochial here because, as Mike pointed out, I've spent a lot of time on cyber the past year or so. I do think cyber is going to challenge so many things that it is an opportunity for us to advance on a broader front, whether it is acquisition or personnel or the intellectual needs. And so, for example, I'm going to have some hearings in this budget cycle in my subcommittee about cyber and the very hard problems that it presents in a military context. What is war? What do we expect the federal government to do to defend commercial enterprises and so forth? So I think things that get to this the cultural reforms that is really at the heart of this. And I really agree with you that it is the intellectual capacity, not just of the Department of Defense, but across the broader national security-related agencies, is really central to this.
Sir, good morning. George Nicholson from StratCorp. First, I want to thank you for everything that you've done and your predecessor, Adam Smith, and Jim Saxton, on your committee. The question I've got, you talk about the industrial base. We look at programs like the replacement for the OH-58 helicopter. The first one was the Lockheed Cheyenne, built, flown, canceled. Next replacement was the Sikorsky Boeing Comanche, built, flown, canceled. And then in your own district, the Bell AH-ARH, built, flown, canceled. What have we learned from that, and what are the impacts going to be on the industrial base?
I can't remember the number, but somebody has put together the number of how much money we've spent over the last 10 years developing weapon systems that get canceled, and maybe there's some technology that can be harvested from them. But it's an incredible number of billions and billions of dollars that we just pull the plug out and basically don't have anything to show for a huge investment. So certainly in a time of tight budgets, we all have to find a way to deal with that. And there's been, you know, a number of recommendations from tightening up the requirements process at the beginning to not letting those requirements continue to shift as it's underway, to different sorts of contracting methods that have all kind of gotten at some of this stuff. I think we've had some sort of acquisition reform basically every other, or something that was called acquisition reform, basically every other year since I've been around here. I'm kind of to the point where I think of it kind of like the tax code. We just need to stop. It would just wipe it all out and start over. I'm somewhat cavalier in saying that, but still, I think that we're gonna have to. We cannot continue to do the kinds of things that you have just mentioned. And I think there are a number of studies that provide some helpful recommendations. But again, part of it is whatever system you set up, there's going to be some abuse or some mistake. And the question is how self-correcting we are without adding all of these barnacles and stuff, which really have developed, I think, over the past several decades. It's part of probably our biggest challenge in an age of restricted resources.
Here in the front row. Mark Davis, Lighthouse Writers Group.
Earlier it was suggested that we might eliminate or scrap one leg of the nuclear triad deterrent that we have. Is that a good place to go for savings, budgetary savings? Is that a reasonable or safe thing to do?
I don't think so. Now, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I think that there is wisdom in a triad of systems so that we are not overly dependent upon either one. And I think that there is a danger in going too low in the nuclear field just because it makes it more attractive for others to jump up and reach you. And I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, where that magic level is. We can cut this far but no further before we start encouraging other nations to add to their nuclear capability in order to equal us. But I'm particularly with the nuclear deterrent, I am probably more cautious than many, but I don't think we better cut too low, and I think we better keep a triad of delivery systems to have the sort of survivability that brings.
Clara.
Thank you. Clara O'Donnell, visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. I was wondering, to what extent are you concerned by the ongoing defense spending cuts taking place in Europe? And to what extent do you expect that it might hinder future transatlantic defense cooperation?
No, I think it is a significant concern. Ideally, as I mentioned, we work with others. And that means others have to have a capability that complements ours. And if others can have a capability that complements ours, we don't have to do it as much. And everybody can be, you know, more efficient. If the others don't have a capability, then that stretches us thinner. And so, that, you know, that just kind of at a basic level, I think that's worrisome. I don't know to what extent further significant cuts in a country's defense budget affects the attitude of the people in that nation towards national security, whether it undermines their responsibility to provide for their own security, or is it the kind of thing that we don't need to spend money on that, the Americans will take care of it, I think that worries me some, and that's more of kind of a cultural psychological thing, but we're all under enormous stress in our budgets, and it's understandable that there would be a desire to cut further in defense. But seems to me that it would be a dangerous road to go. And as I tell people in my town hall meetings, you can wipe out the defense budget and all of foreign aid and all the rest of discretionary spending, and we still would have had a deficit last year. So that's not where the problem is at home.
Honor de Borgraf, CSIS, says, you look at the future and look for savings. How large a role does robotic warfare figure in your thinking?
I think it is inevitably going to be a larger and larger role in our future. And as Dr. Singer has written about, I think it also presents some legal, policy, and ethical challenges for us as we move further in that direction, in a similar way that cyber does. So it's not just a newer, better version of what we've been doing all along. It adds some new dimensions that is incumbent upon policymakers, not just scientists, to work our way through. But obviously, with the premium we put on human life, the desirability of have airplanes and submarines that can not have human pilots is going to be the strongest current. And not to mention longevity in the air or underwater, not to mention various capabilities that where the human provides some restraint or constraints on us. So I think it's inevitable, but I kind of turn the mirror back our direction. We need to help the country work our way through some of those ethical and policy issues as we continue to move in.
Morning, Congressman Otto Kreischer with CPower and AOL Defense. Two issues. One, the industrial base has been, particularly AIA and others, have been pleading for reform on the export controls. You know, if they can sell overseas more, it helps them, you know, with reductions here. The administration has made some steps. Part of the problem is going to be getting Congress to approve the single list, you know, and those sort of things. What's your view on that policy? And the other one is, when you get into tough times like this, the tendency is not to cancel programs, but to stretch them out. Doesn't that inevitably add to the cost of everything you buy?
Yes, absolutely. Reportedly, the Secretary is going to recommend stretching out F-35 buys today, and that will make them more expensive. And we have a history of stretching things out, making them more expensive, and then deciding, oh, it's too expensive for us to buy, we better cancel it. That cycle we get ourselves into again, which comes back to I think a lot of our basic acquisition approach and the difficulty in planning ahead. On the export controls, I think it's a good idea to have a single list. Dutch Ruppersberger and I have pursued this, especially when it comes to some of the satellite manufacturers. And back to the topic of industrial base, that if we put too much restraint on our company's ability to sell their goods overseas, it makes it harder for them to survive. And that is what's happened to some extent, for example, with satellite makers. And so, you know, you don't want to remove all constraints, and you understand the how good some people in the world are at copying technology or and so forth. But at the same time, overreacting the other way causes our industrial base, I think, to shrink and shrink. And that's and so it has not kept up. Our laws have not kept up with the way the world has changed in this and a whole host of areas. And so I do think we should.
Yes, my name is Gru Holm, and I'm representing Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation, so I'm one of the allies. But my question is more political. To what extent has your committee been discussing lessons learned from the war in Iraq, from the soon-to-finish, we hope, war in Afghanistan? In 2.5 years' time, the forces will be out. Have you discussed the lessons learned and eventually the consequences those might have for thinking about future industry and thinking about future priorities? There was a surge, 30,000 U.S. troops a few years ago, 10,000 other troops from Europe. Have they been effective? Have the lessons learned there told you something about how the American defense should look like in the future?
I think the answer is we have not spent nearly enough time trying to understand the lessons learned of the past decade. And it is one of the ways I think Congress has not fully fulfilled its role in our system of government. I guess that sort of concern is part of the reason that I have had and will have more hearings on irregular warfare. Because part of what I want to try to do is kind of look at what we've learned and make sure that it doesn't just go back on the bookshelf, that we really do learn and apply the lessons that have come, whether it's in our organizational structure or whether it's in the stuff we buy or whatever. So I do think that. I also worry, and again, this may be slightly parochial, but a number of years ago, Senators Lieberman, Coates, and I had bills to create the Joint Forces Command. And part of the purpose of that command was experimentation so that you could look at things in the future, but also this having kind of an independent organization that was responsible for joint lessons learned. And they did some studies on lessons learned that I think were generally helpful. That command has been abolished now. So where is it in our system that you've got folks that are focused on kind of the broader lessons that so that we can learn them, apply them, and move ahead? And I'm not sure where that is now. I'm not sure it was a mistake to disabolish that command, by the way, because it never really lived up to what we had hoped it would do. But the point is the need for that sort of thing, experimentation among others, I think still is there.
Hi, I'm Jen DiMascio with Aviation Week. I wanted to drill down about the F-35. You mentioned that the Secretary is going to recommend, slowing down the buy or stretching it out, and you said, that's likely to increase the cost. Is that a move that you're likely to oppose in Congress this year? How do you balance the need to cut the budget this year and in the future with the potential for making weapon systems like the F-35 more expensive in the long run? And does the F-35 fit into your vision for smart defense?
Well, first, remember this year, the top line on defense is decided. That was part of the budget agreement last year, so it is not an option for 2013 to increase the amount of money, basically, that we spend on the base budget of defense. Now, the overseas contingency account is not part of that, but basically the number is decided. And so that puts certain constraints on all of us. But I think we do have to be aware that it is so tempting and easy to stretch things out, oh, we don't need to buy, you know, this number, we'll buy this year, we can buy fewer and we'll buy them next year or the next year, and then we do more of it, you know, more of the stretching out again and again. And the inevitable result of that is incredibly is cost that continue to go up. Now, you know, you one would look at where the F-35 is in the process of its development. Obviously, the B version has had problems, and so you can delay things for technical reasons. But I'm talking about purely for budgetary reasons. You know, I think the country needs to have top-rate fighters, and certainly the idea that there would be a fighter that would be shared by the services and by allies is a very attractive concept that I think we should not walk away from. On the other hand, speaking of lessons learned, let's study this program. And from its inception to its development and acquisition, and see what acquisition lessons we can learn from that, I think that might be the most helpful way to proceed, because clearly it has not performed well from an acquisition standpoint.
Well, Congressman, that was fantastic. Everyone, please join me in thanks. And as the Congressman departs, he's been so concise and compelling and cogent, and so have you, and crisp in your answers, that you've earned a coffee break. We are not going to take a long one, because we do want to start by 11, recognizing that we're finishing by 12. But before I invite you to look for some refills, let me just make brief note that as an added incentive to get back here by 11, we can inquire from Peter Singer, who's going to moderate the next panel, just how he sizes nuclear forces for alien attack. This is something I've had in the back of my mind ever since he mentioned it an hour ago. And we also have two great representatives from industry, David Morrison from a traditional player, Boeing, which, of course, remains very innovative, but it's traditional, and David Warren from a new player, a relatively new player, and also very innovative, Palantir. So we'll resume right at 11. Thanks.